I'm Jonathan Zittrain. I teach here at Harvard Law in the Berkman Center. And I am honored to preside over, given the season that we're in, what we should call an electronic town hall. Remember Ross Perot from 1992? Those were good times. And speaking of good times, despite the fact that we're in the midst of a global financial meltdown and engaged in several wars, et cetera, there's still an internet, right? At least there's the Numa Numa guy. But what we want to ask over the next 75 minutes or so is, well, can we rely on the internet forever? Is it as apolitical as it might appear at first? Hint, answer, no. And what are the values embedded within it? What are the values we'd like to see? What are some of the big policy challenges that we'll be facing? A new Congress, likely a new balance of power on a Federal Communications Commission, different governmental regulatory entities, bodies around the world in the next interval as we see sort of political turnover taking place. We've got some great people at the front of the room to help us think over these questions. We have some great people in the room. It's clear there's a brain trust here, so we should break down that wall early and often. along those lines, we've already set up the Berkman Center question tool. If you are on a laptop or an iPhone or a souped-up typewriter, you can go to cyber.law.harvard.edu/questions. Take the drop-down box down to Uncertain Internet and join the question-answer system as we go along here. And at times, that'll be up on the screen. But at the moment, the screen is set to the rarely used DVD setting because we have a special introductory video of sorts that came about in part thanks to the sponsor and generous partner for this event, the Ford Foundation. And Jenny Toomey from Ford is here. Where did you go, Jenny? Where are you? There you are. You're in the very front row, which is where you'd least expect to find anyone. Jenny, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, about Ford, your interest in this, and about the video we're about to watch.
Wow, it's so funny. I feel like I'm testifying before Congress on one of these. I don't recollect the answer to that question.
Tell us about your day back.
A little bit less than what they said it was. My name is Jenny Toomey, and I am the media. I feel maybe I should just do this.
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, but then the recording for posterity is not. You don't want us to dub you with. There you go. Perfect.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jenny Toomey, and I am the media policy program officer at the Ford Foundation. Those signs. I really do feel like I'm kneeling before the types of people who come to Berkman. I always love it here, and I always talk about how great it is, but then when I get here and I'm about to see one of these events, I think, oh, it's much better than I ever remembered that it was. So I'm not going to waste too much of your time. I just want to give Berkman more credit than they're already going to get, because this film actually came as a result of the Berkman at 10. I actually was supposed to go to dinner the night before Berkman at 10. My friend stood me up, and I went out with a bunch of people I didn't know and ended up stuck in the corner of a restaurant where basically there was no way to get out for like 2 hours. And I happened to be sitting next to Jesse Dillon, who had been in the night before, to actually talk about a film he had done about Barack Obama called Yes We Can Video. I think many of you guys saw it. And talking about the impact that had and politics in it. And he said, what do you do? And I talked about the work that our portfolio is trying to do, protecting the open internet and making sure everyone has access to the benefits of the internet. And after about 2.5 hours of talking about things like net neutrality and open access and universal service, he was really interested and he said, you know, it really shouldn't take 2.5 hours to say this. I'd like to do this in a little film. So what you're about to see is the first showing of this film, and it's just a draft. So if there are things that you think really need to be changed or you hate, or things that you love, please come up and tell me or tell your friends or tell Jesse and Priscilla, who are sitting up there, who actually put it together. And that's it.
Great, wonderful. Thanks. Shall we, as they say, roll the tape?
I made the site in my spare time using completely free technology. A loan is made every 18 seconds on the website. Every day we're lending over $100,000 now, Every 10 days, we lend $1 million. Our user base of 350,000 people has lent out about $43 million to about 60,000 borrowers.
We Feel Fine automatically runs every 3 or 4 minutes, and it's been running for about 4 years now, having collected about 11 million feelings in all now.
So one of the things we did is we made a video that showed a simulated election and showed us stealing that simulated election. And we took that video and we put it on our website and we let people put it up on YouTube. And within a few days, about 500,000 people had viewed it.
20,000 people coming to talk about a piece of legislation.
15 million low-income individuals have used the Beehive website to find information and to help their lives.
Well, I sent it to 17 people, and within a few days, over 1 million people were coming to it a day.
When I told people the idea, no one thought it was funny. If you were pitching that at a network, they would have said no, like there's no way to do it. It's the second most viewed video in internet history. It's approaching 60 million hits.
By the time our next record came out, a video of us dancing in our backyard had been downloaded hundreds of thousands of times before the label could even figure out what single to choose. There's been hundreds of remakes of our videos by our fans, and I suspect they're mostly trying to impress each other. I think that like what they really want to do is stand out in the community of weirdos.
It was a global phenomenon within 18 months of that decision to build the software. It had enormous reach because the internet was an open place and they could get on the internet and distribute Skype globally.
There are some applications that it never would have occurred to me to think about in the course of designing the network. In fact, we were careful in this design to be application agnostic. The internet has no idea what's being transported on it. It doesn't know if it's voice or video or a piece of a web page or part of an email. And incredibly, that means the network is completely open to every conceivable application that you can invent.
Some people call that net neutrality, which is that the architecture is neutral as to whether or not I'm moving giant databases about science or movies. But I like to think of it more in terms of my rights as an internet user, which is that I should have a right as an internet user to have access to a neutral architecture that lets me innovate with no more restriction than fulfilling the technical protocols.
Openness means you control, I control, all users control. Closeness means the network provider, the service provider that allows you to get on the internet controls what you do, what you see, what quality, what speed.
From YouTube to Skype to NPR.org to your blog to my family website, all of the content on the internet is currently controlled by the user. And policies will shape whether it stays that way or whether control shifts away from the user and to the owner of the network.
Companies like Google, eBay, and Yahoo all started as just a few people with a great idea in an apartment or a garage or a trailer and grew up to what they are today from that start. And what we risk losing is the next generation because they'll need someone's permission. They'll have to convince somebody that what they want to do makes sense instead of just putting it out there and letting the users and the citizens decide.
It's this choice and openness that has permitted so much American innovation in the network environment. And if we inhibit access to the internet's resources in some way, you will also foreclose a great deal of experimentation that should be taking place, and other places in the world that have a more open access will do better than we do.
Any of the proposals now on the table that would limit citizens' access to the internet would limit their participation in this democracy. It would be, you know, one of the ultimate outrages that as the internet is enabling more people to be engaged, that it would be shut down.
But the right of freedom isn't enough. You also need the power to speak. And so making sure that freedom of speech is secure online means making sure people have the power to access the internet, making sure they have the freedom to access content on the internet, and making sure they have the right to use the internet.
If you don't have access to the internet, you can't get a job, you can't find housing information, you can't access a lot of government services, you can't apply to schools and colleges.
I think all we can do in public policy positions and in the nonprofit sector is help people reach their own tipping point. There's no more powerful tool than the internet that can help that person have that moment of self-discovery, that aha moment that says, I've got it. I can take action in my own best interest.
We assumed that we would be the first for whom all of our citizenry would have access. We assumed that issues of fairness were inherent in the way we had allowed the internet to roll out. And I think it's quite shocking today to recognize that we're number 17 in terms of broadband penetration and access.
The internet, broadband specifically, in my mind, is a public utility.
It is infrastructure. It's like highways for the 21st century. And we need to lower the cost and make it broadly accessible because it will be a platform on which an extraordinary amount of economic and non-economic activity will happen.
It is so important to understand that the policy decisions that are going to be made in Washington over the next 5 years are really going to determine the future of the internet. And we've seen what happens in prior policy debates around radio ownership and media, the dangers of not engaging in those debates.
There's an extraordinary amount of money in Washington right now lobbying the decision makers to permit the network to be re-architected so that this outside, non-profit, non-commercial, as well as commercial innovation can't happen in the same way.
I think that it goes in the direction of all life and all culture, you know. It balloons out in every possible direction and looks just like life.
Every single person in the world probably knows something that you and I don't know. And if it's possible for that information to show up in a discoverable way, we're all much better off for it.
When Maya goes to school, I want to make sure that she can use the internet to educate herself. I hope she can use the internet to find a job and to meet her friends and to take advantage of communications tools that we can only dream of.
It's the things that are going to come out of left field that you couldn't have predicted that we're really going to lose. And we won't know what we lost. And a whole bunch of voices that could have been heard won't be heard.
What we have to dream about is what would happen if every home had access to broadband service. And that broadband service was free, and it was fast, and it was fair.
Thank you, Jesse and Priscilla, for putting that together. How long did that take?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. Wow. And you guys are available for hire, right? So, like, any form of propaganda or just the good stuff? All right. Ready to lead. Appreciate it. Let's get started with our generous panelists. Let's start with you, Susan Crawford. Tell us who you are.
Who am I? Well, first of all, I'm a really happy person to be here and talk to you about the things that I care about the most. I really think that the internet, having a free and open internet, will create a better future for us and that we're in grave danger of slipping down a pretty sharp hill to some bad output. So my name is Susan Crawford. And I am the founder of One Web Day, which is an annual Earth Day for the internet every September 22nd. And I'm a professor at the University of Michigan Law School. And I'm on the board of ICANN. But I'm an internet enthusiast, mainly. I am worried about our future, and I take every opportunity I can to ask people to do things like leverage fear. Watch what the Chinese and the Indians are doing. Watch our own country slipping behind. When Sputnik was launched, we went into action. And when that happened, we started the research that got the internet going. So why not leverage fear right now? Other countries are getting way ahead of us. And we are at great risk of being extraordinarily complacent. Extraordinarily complacent. Somebody yesterday said to me, Susan, you know, what are you worried about? Things are so much better now than they were in 1988. And I said, yes, but compared to what? This is the sort of the rights of the unborn that we have to worry about. And so we're at risk of believing that private parties and the private marketplace can provide all kinds of important basic research and basic communications to us. And that turns out not to be true. So I hope we have a chance to talk about that.
And if you were czar.
Yeah.
What? Tell us a policy kind of prescriptions. What are the biggest icebergs to avoid or directions we should be going?
You know where we should go? We should have basic fiber available to everybody in this country. And the control over that fiber should be separated from the content that runs over it. Singapore is doing this. It's radical. actual structural separation between the pipe and the stuff on it. That should be our policy for basic communications. It has been for the last 150 years for telephony and telegraph and the post. That's what we tried to do. We've screwed it up in the last 5 years.
And have you already figured out who pays for it and how it happens?
I have, actually, Jonathan. Singapore...
I feel like we're in an infomercial. Please tell me about this amazing policy.
This is a matter of investment by our country. We could, with a couple $100 billion, bring fiber to everyone in this country. Singapore is doing it through loans to private operators, and the cities of Amsterdam and Stockholm have acted that way too. So it can be a public-private partnership. What's really important is the control over that basic fiber, and that it not be allowed to seep upwards into things we do using that body of communication.
Got it.
Doesn't she sound like a great federal communications commissioner or chairwoman in the making?
By acclamation, it is so ordered. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you,
and
John.
From having served on the ICAM board, it's clear you're up for, you're like Mikey in that old ad, you'll eat any bowl of cereal put in front of
you.
Hey,
I'm taking on Michigan broadband policy. Watch this. I have some stories to tell you about this.
Excellent. Alec, tell us about yourself.
Gosh, I'm a former public school teacher. I was in Teach for America and taught middle schoolers in West Baltimore for a number of years. And one of the things that I learned teaching in one of the poorest and most violent communities in the United States is that it really doesn't matter how much money you have in your wallet or how much melanin you have in your skin. If you're a young person, the use of technology is incredibly intuitive to you. And like everybody else in the mid and late 90s, I was witnessing this technology-led transformation of the economy and of the way that people communicated and transacted business and said, you know, we ought to do something to help build a bridge between people living in poverty and the digital age. So I started a nonprofit 8 years ago designed to do exactly that. And now, in addition to helping lead my nonprofit One Economy, I help run technology, media, and telecommunications policy for Barack Obama's presidential campaign.
Got it. And what is your lead policy prescription? What would you do in the first 10 minutes of holding the czar's quill?
You know, if we've got 10 minutes, there are a lot of executive orders that need to be issued and a lot of executive orders that need to be rescinded.
Okay.
But in all seriousness, there's a very... Let me back up for a second. A lot of the time, presidential politics is justifiably criticized for existing really sort of in the realm of sort of higher rhetoric. And all too often we can justifiably criticize our candidates for not really taking honest approaches to policymaking and not really getting into the weeds and not really looking at how to implement progressive, smart, aggressive policies. I'm a Kool-Aid chugging Barack Obama fan, but anybody who isn't can look at the technology and innovation agenda which Barack Obama announced last November at Google and which you can see on his website. And if you actually take the time to read it, what you'll say is that this is something very different than you tend to see in presidential politics. I mean, we get very, very detailed. And I know one of the topics of focus here today is regarding the openness of the internet. And the policy set forward around network neutrality, for example, in Barack's technology and innovation agenda, it isn't just sort of one cute sentence. It gets very specific about what he means by network neutrality and by those things that need to be done proactively to ensure that the internet remains open and accessible to all. So there's a lot that needs to be done, Jonathan. There's a lot that needs to be done in terms of broadband policy. There's not a lot that needs to be done in terms of innovation and science policy. And
so just hum a few bars. Give us a blade of grass.
Sure. Right,
we've got the forest down.
So reforming universal service. So right now, universal service is about a $7 billion annual program, and the majority of that goes towards subsidizing copper. Most of that goes towards subsidizing telephony. You know, Barack believes that we ought to take a completely unsubtle approach to reforming universal service and set a date certain for changing the Universal Service Program from something that principally supports voice communications to something that subsidizes advanced networks.
So and in short, Universal Service is basically a cash transfer from where to where?
It's a cash transfer from taxpayers through their monthly phone bills to the FCC, which in turn is directed toward carriers to subsidize service in hard-to-reach places.
Got it. Telephone service.
Telephone service. And we think that the telephony networks between wired and wireless are sufficient such that at this point we can really turn our attention toward broadband, which has an economic bottom line that goes far deeper than people being able to get and make phone calls.
Got it. And do you know to an order of magnitude just how much money is moving each year in your
$7 billion.
About $7 billion a year.
$7 billion. So that over the course of 4 years, you're talking about directing north of $20 billion. And revenue neutral, don't add a nickel to it. Don't add a nickel to it. Just flip it from being something that subsidizes telephone service to something that subsidizes broadband. Revenue neutral, you've got over $20 billion that you can use to subsidize broadband into poor or hard-to-reach communities. That is something that can bridge the digital divide at an order of magnitude that we haven't seen since E-rate and was enacted in the late 90s.
And Alec, here's a picayune question for you. I don't mean to deride it by that, but
sure.
An anonymous person pays little to no phone tax by signing, or is Alec, no, that is to you, Alec.
What's it?
By signing up for online billing, changing my cell phone address to the Bellagio Hotel in Las Vegas. Would Obama take this loophole away from me?
Repeat the question.
Anybody want to actually come forward as the person who typed that in? Ah, Chris, tell us, Chris. You know, if I had to guess, I would say
Chris Segoia.
Never actually. So tax varies by state. Many people don't agree with the huge amounts of tax that they're charged by their states. And the information is self-reported by consumers. So many, many consumers, this is actually a technique promoted by consumerist.com, a consumerist blog, have changed their address to be virtual addresses in Nevada.
So people are breaking the law.
It's not illegal to lie about your address.
It's not illegal to submit a false tax. It's not illegal. So let's back up. So I live in Baltimore, Maryland. You're telling me that if I get a P.O. box in Nevada, that me, my wife, and my three kids can stop paying taxes to the state of Maryland?
Not your state taxes that you would send in every year, but your cell phone taxes, sure.
My cell phone taxes. Well,
I'm going to pull a Tom Brokaw now and not invoke the rules that we all previously agreed to because we didn't have any. But to say, interesting, snarky question, not necessarily a ill-advised one. My guess is, if it's a loophole, damn it, let's close it. I'm not speaking for Barack Obama, of course. And if it's not, I want one too.
But this is one of the nice things about being at Harvard, though, because, you know, instead of doing so much talking, I should do some listening, because in 2 years of doing this, I haven't heard that. And by virtue of that, I think Barack probably hadn't heard it, so we'll look into it.
The other question for you is... the other question for you is... Why should we trust Obama on net neutrality, given his massive pro-AT&T flip-flop on FISA and warrantless wiretapping?
You know, I mean, it's interesting. If you really want to understand Barack Obama on technology, and I'm going to get to this point in a minute, but there's been a lot of criticism of Barack recently for being having a background as a community organizer. And I think that I think the best way to understand the distinction between Barack Obama and John McCain in terms of the internet is to look at what they were doing when they were in their 20s. Barack was a community organizer. John McCain was in the military. And if you back up a little bit and think about the role of information in both of those places, they're very different. A community organizer uses information as a way of building power, there's a virtue in information sharing. There's a virtue in getting information to people who otherwise don't have it so they can take action that's to their self-benefit. In the military, it's command and control, information on a need-to-know basis. And what I found, and this is just a personal observation, is that each of their approach to internet policy seems to flow from that construct. And I think that Barack views, I know that Barack views the internet as something that's very empowering. It's a way to give power and a way to give information to people who otherwise don't have it. And I think that John McCain sees the internet as a scary place, and certainly a place that he doesn't spend much time. Now, going to specifically to the question of network neutrality, I can just attest to the fact that he really dug in on the issue. Barack is very comfortable in settings like this. He's very much the University of Chicago constitutional law professor. And he dug in deeply on the question of network neutrality. He's been very specific very many times about his commitment to it. And, you know, it would shock me to no end for him to reverse himself on this, simply having, you know, witnessed the process he went through to educate himself about it.
And let me just ask a final question, then we should move on to Ross. Do you have a sense, a crisp sense, of what net neutrality is, what it would mean?
You know, I certainly know what net neutrality is. I think, though, that from my experience, it continues to be a little bit of a moving target. And so from our perspective, a lot of what we've done is we've enlisted some very smart advisors in this space.
Yeah.
So Tim Wu from Columbia Law School, Larry Lessig from Stanford Law School, Ben Scott from Free Press and others, is as the telecommunications companies try to reframe the issue, or as people attempt to reframe it in the wireless space, or as people try to twist the policy, part of what we do is we rely on a very smart, very sophisticated network of advisors, you know, some of whom were on that video, like Gigi Sohn and others, people who have their ear to the ground, who monitor the issue every day, who are very committed to preserving the openness of the internet. These are the people who Barack Obama trusts.
Got it. Rich, tell us about yourself.
So let's see, I too like Kool-Aid. I'm.
It's actually a horrible historical reference. If you, yeah. I mean, for those of you who know what, yeah. So it's rare that people are proudly like, "I drank the Kool-Aid."
Yeah. I'm going to need a rest after this election. So.
Yes. Anyway, we digress.
Sure. So I'm not a policy person. I'm more of a serial entrepreneur, and that's had me for the past number of years in the mobile space primarily. I had one startup that was acquired by a European mobile company that was owned by the France Telecom Group. So from startup to very large company, did another startup that was around for a brief period of time before we ended up getting acquired by Google. And so I've been in the mobile space for quite a while, and I'm not familiar with this open internet that these guys are talking about, because the mobile internet that I'm familiar with already is one that's heavily edited, that has walled gardens, as they refer to them, where people like a Verizon will, you know, choose the content that they think is the content that you want to have delivered, and the whole concept of openness historically hasn't necessarily been there. Now, you know, what I was doing before Google acquired me was building a handset platform called Android, an open mobile phone platform that we've recently announced that there will be handsets in another couple of weeks at your local T-Mobile store that are fairly open and based on this open handset platform. And also, I was involved in our 700 megahertz work. I've been participating in the discussions on white spaces. And the good news is, you know, maybe to anticipate a question about what I would change, the good news is I'm actually happy with, you know, just looking back 18 months and also give Apple some credit with what's happened with the iPhone, that just in the past 18 months, you know, at that time, Verizon didn't have a guy whose title was VP of Open. You know, you didn't have something like the iPhone that effectively, you know, I think in a good way, wake-up call, cut the operators out and had 100 million downloads in a very brief period of time of applications, any application that the consumer wanted to download that has a web browser that's very much a desktop-like web browser, lets users go anywhere. So, you know, so since we've started down this openness path relative to to mobile and airwaves, we're seeing good progress. Even the FCC stepped up in the 700 megahertz and listened to us a little bit and put some openness principles in the 700 megahertz auction.
Now, I'm just curious, for those, you know, we have a full room here, how inside baseball is this feeling already? When somebody says 700 megahertz, you're like, yeah, 700 megahertz auction, things going well there. Are you like, 700 megahertz, does that have to do with my microwave? I'm just, any, how much do we have to unpack
this? You guys
remember
that auction? Yes. Good question.
My microwave.
Microwave. So the person who has yet to find a seat has asked you to unpack
sure.
700 megahertz a little
bit. So basically, you know, all of our mobile phones, you know, operate on spectrum, airwaves, some chunk of the airwaves that has been, you know, that was originally public and owned by the government and that was licensed off to companies to build big enterprises and some would claim almost monopolies around. So these were public, it was a public commodity that was sold for some price to make the government a quick buck. To give somebody the only right, an exclusive right, to operate phones over whatever policies and restrictions they wanted to, for the most part, in those airways. The 700 megahertz auction was one of the last auctions of a large available chunk of valuable spectrum that was going to be auctioned. So think of it as a good analogy is just national parks, which are real estate, and auctioning it off. So when they were going to auction off this last chunk of spectrum, Google and some others said, geez, you know, please, FCC, impose some principles when you're going to, on the companies that are going to buy the spectrum to force them to have some openness guidelines. Let a consumer put any device, just like your home telephone. You can buy any telephone. It wasn't always that way. You used to have to buy an AT&T Bell telephone, right? So most mobile phone companies, you buy the phone from their store. We wanted to see that you could buy any phone, that you could download any app, that you wouldn't be blocked, that you know, if you were a startup trying to deliver content, you wouldn't be blocked based on who you were. So we just wanted to see some openness principles in this last bit of spectrum. And we also, you know, in addition to that 700 megahertz spectrum, this concept of white spaces, we're also, you know, somebody brought up microwaves. It turns out microwaves, the whole microwave oven came out of an open chunk of spectrum that the government actually didn't think was worth anything and just told people, use this chunk of spectrum for whatever you want. And out of that chunk of spectrum came microwave ovens, came Wi-Fi, which is unlicensed spectrum, a whole bunch of valuable things. And so we're also pushing for this initiative we might talk a little bit more about called White Spaces, which is there's a whole bunch of available space in the TV bands today that we think if the government would open those up would enable the same types of innovations we saw with microwave, with Wi-Fi, and other technologies like your wireless home phone that use that unlicensed spectrum.
Got it. And one of the questions, the first question actually to hit the question tool was, what's in it for Google? Well, it's very eleemosynary of the firm to be excited about, hey, everybody, here's a protocol for an open handset, go to town. How does it end up redounding to Google's benefit? What's the catch?
Yeah, so this is a hard one to believe. You know, we were acquired by Google for some amount of cash. Google's put hundreds of millions of dollars into this Android platform, and no one really believes me when I say there hasn't actually been a single business plan that I know of done inside of Google around Android. Because Larry, Sergey, Eric, they don't think about things necessarily in that way. For them, you know, Google was founded based on open tools. The whole company was. And we were founded based on the open internet, as you heard Vint Cerf talking about. And Google very much, you know, our real concern is that if we didn't have Android out there as an open mobile phone platform, that someone else would control this platform that's in all of our pockets, much like one company controls most of the desktop PCs that are used today. And then, therefore, they control the browser and the word processor and the project management software. And we think that when you have monopolistic control, that's not necessarily a good thing. And so for Google, we don't mind even playing fields. We don't mind developing Android and releasing it as open source with no restrictions. Anyone can take it and build something on top of to even compete against us. We don't mind that. If we don't excel, shame on us. What we don't like is when someone else has a competitive advantage. So when Google speaks open, and there aren't many companies that believe this, Google thinks openness down to its core. It's really how do you believe in openness and build business models that, based on your own excellence, you can achieve a business model based on openness, as opposed to having to hardwire, you know, sneak something in to...
Got it.
To...
Are there questions, follow-ups, or issues on this much, on this particular, on either spectrum issues or on Android that's worth dwelling on for a moment from anywhere in the room? Yes, sir. Feel free to tell us who you are, too, and the button turns on the mic.
Hi, I'm Paul Camp, and I just wanted to know if you felt that the open wireless network should also apply to GPS and location-based services, because right now they're pretty locked down across the board with a number of the carriers.
Well, certainly, and again, that's the issue of when a carrier does location-based services, they tend to lock things down and not let you do much. And that's one of the problems that carriers have is they, for a long time, carriers have said, oh, we don't want to be just a dumb pipe. We want to add all this value so we can make lots of money. But then they do have bits of information which could be useful to build on top of, like your location, to build apps so you can find your friends and meet up and what have you. And they're not smart enough or haven't historically been smart enough to release APIs to enable location to be leveraged to build those kind of apps. And so what happens is this phone, the new iPhone, they have GPSs built in. And in the case of Android, any developer can build an app that reads your location and communicates your location and builds on top of that to build value-added apps. Now, that information can be abused, and so you have to have policies of use and hope that people don't abuse that kind of information. But we have those issues with other things in addition to location. So we certainly are very much for openness very deep in this platform, including location and access to network and not blocking any apps from being installed, et cetera.
Got it. I had seen some other hands up on this issue. Yes.
Yes, Craig Andrews. I'm big into the whole open thing as well as you. And one thing I've noticed is that the Android platform is licensed under a license which allows any user of it to not release the changes they make to the Android platform. For example, Motorola just said that they're going to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in tens and twenties of developers on the platform, but they have no obligation to release their changes. How are you going? What is your level of concern with a company like Motorola taking Android, extending it, and never releasing their changes and just captivating the market in the same way existing carriers have?
Yeah, I'm not too worried. You know, I talk a lot to Motorola. They're actually a good partner of ours. We're working closely with them, and they actually want to have a lot of engineers working on that open source code base. Now, the whole reason we open sourced with Apache 2.0 is I don't mind if Motorola adds their own value on top of that. In fact, again, I remember how I started this. I'm a capitalist. I think people should take open stuff and build some of their own value add and be able to charge for that, and I think that's great. So Motorola and all the other partners that we've signed on with early on, and I think most of the community that we've seen, as long as we build a vibrant open source community that's driving that platform forward and innovating, I think people will go on that journey with us. But that doesn't mean there won't be derivative products where somebody puts their own intellectual property in and builds their own proprietary derivative and charges for that.
And I guess for those following at home, it means there is a difference between open source and free software. Yeah. Free software defined as the requirement you're talking about versus open source, not necessarily requiring that. Yes, sir.
I'm John Horrigan, and I wanted to make a connection between openness in the platform and something Alex said about the digital divide and the diversity of voices online. When you look at the data of adoption patterns for handheld devices, African-Americans, Hispanics are more likely to use the handheld for non-voice data applications than white people, which is a very different adoption pattern than the internet as we started to understand it in the late 1990s and early 2000s. So the stakes behind this issue of openness go to diversity of voices and participation on the device that people of color are more likely to use to access the internet than the traditional desktop or even laptop. And I think that's worthwhile in making those links across some of the comments made already.
No, it's a good point. I mean, there's a socioeconomic issue, and you see this more largely if you look at developing countries, the U.S. and Western Europe, where those are historically called two-screen economies, or where we call them two-screen economies, because you have your laptop screen and your mobile phone screen. Emerging markets are much more one-screen economies, and I think what you're seeing here is I'm sure, in the U.S. as well, if somebody has a choice, I need to work, I need to be called, I need to sustain myself, reach out to my kids, what have you, I need a mobile phone, but maybe I can't afford a mobile phone and a PC. This is potentially going to be the only device they have. And that's one of Google's whole goals here. There's actually about 1.2 billion mobile phones sold every year. There's only about 200 million PCs sold every year. There's 3 billion mobile phones in the world today. There's about 850 million PCs. So huge number of more mobile phones. And our whole goal is, you know, if Google's goal is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful, it's important that this device be open, be very powerful and capable. This device has all the power of a desktop PC in 2002. And then hopefully it can you know, in the hands of the masses, give them the ability to get online and have a voice and consume the information they want.
Susan.
Yeah, and just to tie all of these things together, there's a titanic battle going on around the world between these two mindsets, the internet mindset of openness, no permission needed, and the old-fashioned cell phone mindset, which is it's in their DNA to control that network, to monetize every service, to charge for everything differently. And that wireless world is gradually being brought over to the internet world quite thoughtfully in a lot of standard setting procedures around the world that are very hard to follow. Next generation networks they're talking about. And the idea would to be have a cell phone layer on top of PC
internet access so that you would be, your PC would start to feel like a walled garden mobile phone. And to be very concrete about this, Verizon has announced that it wants to employ what it calls the IMS subsystem, Interactive Multimedia Subsystem. Not to get too deep into jargon, but that's this. That's that cell phone overlay on internet access. And they want to deploy that in all of their networks. And they have a tremendous footprint in the United States. So it's exactly this battle that Google is playing with and trying to make sure that there's a competing sidewalk, if you will, you know. A basic way of accessing the internet using mobile phones that is very attractive to lots of fancy device builders and lots of people, so that it starts to swamp the old-fashioned cell phone model.
And Susan, as a telecoms geek who follows this stuff, including all the regulatory issues, have we captured the issues so far that you think face the next administration, the 700 megahertz stuff, white spaces, and maybe pegging certain requirements to their use?
That yeah, there's another big category of things here, which is a little bit regulatory, but let me just step you through it, which is we used to treat basic networks as having an obligation of non-discrimination, right?
Right. You're not allowed to pick winners and losers. All of that has been swamped by the FCC and some credulous courts over the last few years. So another huge issue is to bring back a non-discrimination obligation for basic communications networks, wireless and wireline, and to make sure that there's a government role in overseeing that non-discrimination function.
So to my knowledge, Comcast has not, as they did with the previous Berkman event, bought the seats ahead of time by bussing in people to sit there.
Yeah.
So if Comcast were here, what would they say? Give it your best lawyerly shot. It used to be at Wilmer Cutler Pickering. So pretend for the moment you're working for Comcast. What do you say back?
My name is Joe Waz, and I've invested $2 billion this month in building out Comcast's network. I mean, we're a private business. You don't tell private businesses how to run. You want government creating tech mandates? What are you talking about? These regulators are going to be crazy. We're innovating wildly. We're doing a great job. Private industry is supplying this country with internet access, and you're going to cut us off at the knees? That's what I would say.
Let's hear it for Joe. So, Susan, I hate to have you keep swapping hats, but what's the answer to that?
Well, the answer to that is that when you are in the business of providing internet access, that's a different function from your proprietary, you know, programming that you're shoving down our throats every day. This is different. And traditionally, we've treated basic communications infrastructure differently. You don't get to pretend to be providing that basic infrastructure at the same time as you're acting just like a corner deli.
So let me play jackass law professor for a second.
Yeah.
For a second. If people are like, yeah, right. It's a lifetime calling. Comcast wants to lay some coax right into my house and give me 67 channels, each better than the next, of stuff. So far, you have very little, if anything, to say about what they do. There's some must-carry junk, but put that aside,
yeah,
right?
It's them in a newspaper, as far as I'm concerned.
That's okay. Right. On the other hand, if they choose to devote some portion of that coaxial cable to carriage of bits in an internet kind of sense, now you're going to put a whole bunch of requirements on them,
right? That's right.
Okay. Makes it sound so easy.
And you know what? If Comcast devoted all of their bandwidth to internet access, our speeds would be 100 times faster than they are now. And it might be a good business for them to be this commodity provider of internet access. Gravel pits make a lot of money.
And that idea is free, right? They can take that idea right now if they want.
They can run with that,
okay.
Yeah.
If they wanted to create a channel called the Internet Channel.
That's what they're doing.
So channel 68, is Comcast's selected screen snapshots of the day's interesting websites.
Right.
Any problem with that?
If they called it internet access.
It's a branding issue.
Well, there are false advertising aspects to this,
yes.
Which is why the FTC
So they don't
has
call it that. They'll call it whatever you want them not to call it in order not to have to.
In fact, AT&T does this. They call it the AT&T Yahoo Uverse High Speed Internet Access Service. It's not the internet.
Okay, great. So then we take off the table the false advertising issue.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Well, here's the problem. We really do need basic open internet access for everyone, for our economic growth, cultural development, all these things. We
yes.
need this utility. If Comcast doesn't want to provide it, I guess we can't force them, but to the extent they are providing it, it's something that should, where there should be a government intervention. I see where you're going with this. Everybody, and that's the problem,
yes.
because we have so few choices.
Got it.
There's enough market power for these players that they can just call it whatever they want to and provide it to us. And in Ann Arbor, let me tell you, I'm paying $20 more a month for naked internet access than I would for their bundle, because they don't want you to get plain old internet access, and I have no other choices. There's nowhere else I can go.
Yeah, well, that is one of the problems, is the lack of choices that people have. Broadband is one of the reasons that Google, you know, has offered to invest in the creation of this new Clearwire wireless broadband company that is going to do nationwide wireless, because we just think it makes sense to help encourage additional competition out there. I mean, these are hard issues. These companies, you know, the wireless companies, the fixed line companies, they're spending a lot of, you know, capital investment to put in this infrastructure. And so they have practical business issues and requirements, but that's also why that needs to be balanced with policy, because the internet was originally created off of the DARPANET principles were there. We all realize how important openness is. And so without policy or restrictions, you know, business people will do what business people do, which is try and make as much as they can for their capital outlay.
Terry.
So if you pursue this line for a moment, it seems to me at least possible that network neutrality controls are an alternative to fostering competition in the delivery of internet access. So I'll put this in provocative form. Many of the defenders of network neutrality restrictions of one sort or another emphasize the same fact you point to now, that most American residents, roughly 50%, have a choice of, at best, two suppliers of internet access, and the other 25% have only one, and 25% have none. So imagine that we go down the path sketched by Susan at the outset, and not only provide effective high-speed internet access to everybody through one channel, but through, say, three or four, that Yochai Benkler is successful in getting wireless mesh networks delivered in cities. We have internet over power lines. And so the typical American consumer has four or five ways of getting internet access. Under those circumstances, are we free of all this network neutrality stuff because we can rely upon competition among the suppliers to ensure that customers get as open access as they want? Now, it's true that some of them will like, you know, higher speed downloads than uploads because they don't feel like sharing their blogs with the world at large, and they're more consumers of entertainment, but if that's what they want, that's what they get. Just as long as one of the four or five channels in this competitive environment provides them high speed, unfiltered, equal upload to download, we shouldn't be troubled. So is that right? We should just focus all our energies in getting competition in the telecommunications space, and then we wouldn't have to worry about network neutrality.
Yeah, I'm sorry to be such the grizzled DC veteran on this. We are so, 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 so far from 3, 4, 5 pipes into the home, 3, 4, 5 different forms of high speed access that I literally can't decouple myself from reality sufficiently to imagine America in that state.
Unlike Terry, who appears to be
but you know, God bless you, and
you must have come from Sweden, Terry.
Or something like that, where you have these options. But the problem is that the Telecommunications Act of 1996 envisioned precisely this. That we would have a competitive marketplace where private sector entities would deploy private capital to fight like dogs for access to consumers, and they would layer applications, they would come with differentiated speeds. And what's happened since 1996, through failure of public policy as well as through, every fancy lawyer imaginable working on behalf of the MSOs and the ILECs, is
multiple system operators.
Yeah, I mean, we've just had the eradication of the vision of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, and what we've got is we've essentially got two big phone companies. We've had the reconstitution of Ma Bell in the very recent history. We've had, for all intents and purposes, what we've had is enormous consolidation in the cable industry. So what you describe, I would love for us to have that as a problem. But from my standpoint, the first, second, and third problem we have right now is competition. There's little to none. And what we need to do is discard this notion that fight is lost, and re-examine the resources that the federal government has in terms of spectrum that the DoD is squatting on, in terms of requirements that we attach to the carriers of our bandwidth, and see what we can do to try to re-inject competition back into the system, because otherwise we're never going to get to the point of being able to critically examine network neutrality in that way. We ought to, but we're very, very far from it at this
point. So, Alec, it sounded to me a little bit almost like a conceptual U-turn as you were talking. The first appeared to be, get real, we have nothing approaching competition, and we are so far from it,
right?
Don't even, go that way. That's why we need regulatory oversight of what few pipes there are, because don't expect more. Then you were saying, let's get more pipes.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing, one doesn't preclude the other, or one doesn't distract from or detract from the other.
And there then, does the highway metaphor that Larry used, for example, in the movie, does the highway metaphor fail there? Because it would be kind of silly to imagine private industry building multiple highways to the same place and then expecting competition in asphalt to, provide you the best rate.
I think if Larry were here, I can't speak for Larry, but I think that if he were here, he would say that this may or may not be a natural monopoly. I mean, Vint Cerf, and again, I don't want to put words in Vint's mouth, but I think Vint has opined recently, saying, you know what, maybe telecommunication service is a natural monopoly and we should nationalize the ILECs. I think the best opportunity here is to continue to innovate. And rather than have Washington, D.C. be an enemy of innovation, allow it to be something that encourages innovation. Allow it to be something that helps bring new entrants into the marketplace, and particularly in the wireless space, where we've just begun to scratch the surface of what's possible.
Susan.
Well, these two visions do go together actually beautifully, because the idea is to have a basic substrate on which there are lots and lots of competitors, and that was the vision of the 96 Act. So,
by a basic substrate, you now might mean
the
one pipe,
level zero. Whatever it is, the pipe. I'm actually in favor of dark fiber being the level zero, they call it, the very lowest level, and then lots of people can light that fiber. Go ahead, hundreds of fibers. They go very fast. They're future proof. This will last for 50 years, and there could be lots of competition above the dirt. So, but you guys have hands up there for a long time. Yeah.
Hi, Bob Keyes here. I have a question in regards to spectrum. We've spoken about the 700 megahertz spectrum being freed up by the transition to digital television. But the truth of it is that there's a lot other spectrum out there the technology that has currently been used on it is evolving to the point where this spectrum may be able to be freed up. But it seems to me is that the incumbent users are very reluctant to give up any of their real estate, so to speak. What can be done to free up this space in a way that serves the public needs rather than just lining the pockets of the FCC through auctions.
You should definitely Google white spaces and see what you come up with. But that's to that exact.
Well, the search engine of your choice.
Because there's a large initiative right now around this concept of white spaces, and what we've observed is that as we've moved to digital television, if you look at the spectrum where you're broadcasting different TV channels, there's a huge amount of space, because you don't want TV channels to interfere with one another, there's a huge amount of space in between the television channels. So you're broadcasting here and here, and that space in between is free and available. And it turns out if you look at all of the space for all the channels, and you look at all the gaps in between them, and you put them together, there's like 200 megahertz worth of spectrum in most markets. And 200 megahertz is effectively more than any of the large mobile phone carriers have in any one market. It's a lot of spectrum. You could do a lot with it. You could deliver free wireless broadband in an ad hoc way or controlled way to very large populations of people. And we're fighting this exact battle because there's a couple of issues. One is the broadcasters say, but wait, that's our spectrum, right? We know we're not using it, but they might interfere with us. It could cause problems. And Google, Microsoft, and others have developed technology which sniffs out where there's TV and only uses that white space that's not being used. Problem is wireless mics, your local church or here if we had wireless mics, those wireless mics also broadcast in that white space. So we propose other technology, little beacons that you can say, I'm broadcasting my mic in this area. Don't use this particular white space. So we have technical solutions, but there's a big battle right now going on in Washington. There's lobbying on both sides. We're investing an awful lot in it. Larry Page was just down, one of our founders of Google was just down in D.C. Testifying on this. And it's, this is just an example where it could go either way at this point.
So Esther Hargitay, tell us who you are and explain your question, which is now glowing a reddish color because it's had 5 votes.
Esther Hargitay, Berkman Fellow and faculty at Northwestern. I found the movie interesting in that it was pretty much solely focused on the physical access divide, and research has shown that that's not the only source of inequality. In fact, people's socioeconomic status predicts the extent to which people can benefit from the internet even when you control for access. So I'm just wondering, I just think it's really important to shift the discussion, at least to some extent, away from assuming that it's a simple, let's throw money at...
What would your policy prescription be on that front? Is it an education issue then?
My position is that we definitely need to also throw money at training, not just the pipes.
Yeah. Throw money at training.
Yeah. Let me speak to that a little bit, and let me take my Barack Obama hat off for a second, because my 9-to-5 is actually focusing specifically on this issue, and Esther, you're exactly right, though I wouldn't call it training. It's very interesting. If you actually look at John Horrigan's research, the guy sitting right beside you, who does, in my opinion, the best research in this space, part of what he and Pew have demonstrated is that access, issues of access and affordability, while important, are actually not the dominant reasons why people don't connect to the network. The principal reasons why people don't connect to the network are, and this is going to be remarkable to people here at the Berkman Center, one, a perception that there isn't something there for me. And additionally,
they don't like dancing hamsters?
Yeah. And also, a lot of people consider the internet to be a dark and dangerous place where identities are going to be stolen, where children are going to be predated on. And so my nonprofit, One Economy, which has grown from being 4 guys in a basement to the world's largest digital divide nonprofit, a lot of our work in the early years when we were founded in 2000, 2001, 2002 was focused on access issues. And what we found in recent years is that you can actually have the highest ROI on education issues, actually educating people who aren't online right now, non-native English speakers, people of low incomes, about the value of connecting to the internet, explaining to people that if they're looking for a job, 92% of all Fortune 500 companies only accept resumes electronically. And so education is incredibly important. A lot of people assume that training is important, and I think training is important. And we've actually got 1,800 teenagers who we employ to do training in their communities. But a lot of what we've found is that the sort of the ability to use the internet, the ability to use computing devices, disaggregates more based along generational lines than based along household income lines. So it's interesting. I agree with your general point, though, that we've got to focus increasingly on education to get people online rather than just looking at the access issue.
Esther, we'll give you a quick last word on this, then we'll move on.
Training and education, in my mind, are the same. I thought you were disagreeing with me, but I guess we agree.
Yeah. I just mean you don't, I think when I say it, we don't oftentimes need to, you know, show Mrs. Jones how to use the mouse. I think we don't have to be paternalistic in terms of
I mean training
how,
much more broadly defined
okay,
than that.
Good. We're in violent agreement.
So what are we missing? What's missing on this list? Yes, sir.
The relationship between what you're all talking about and your good mood and the state of the stock market and the economy. I have difficulty reconciling those two phenomena.
Because there's no money left. We've already given it all away. Is that what you mean? With an economy in this state, who's going to invest in anything, whether from the government fisc or from private industry?
Sure.
This is a really big deal. You know, we just wiped another 6% off of the Dow today. You know, part of what has distinguished Barack Obama is he's made a series of very aggressive commitments to funding innovation. $150 billion to create alternative energy, $50 billion to do venture investing in clean tech, $50 billion to move to electronic health records. You know, a lot of things that actually have big dollar signs attached to them. And part of what is scaring us to death is that, you know, the car of the American economy is being run at 120 miles per hour into a ditch. And the implications for what that means on the investment side are horrifying. The CBO hasn't even begun to contemplate what the reduction in receipts are going to be to the Treasury and what a projected FY 2010 budget would be. So
you
without coming up with a solution, yeah. It is a huge issue. So doing things that are revenue neutral, like flipping the universal service program from a voice-based program to a broadband-based program, is important. To the extent that you can do things without digging further into Treasury becomes increasingly important.
There was a lingering question on that. To the extent that you flip the program, are there people that can't get the telephone in rural Tennessee anymore?
You know, I'm not going to say there's nobody. I mean, but the simple fact of the matter is that we've done decades now of investing into doing these build-outs into rural communities. And I imagine Susan knows a lot more about this than me. But as a very practical matter, you've got a lot of very small rural phone companies right now which have dividends, which have yields in double digits, in part because they live exclusively on USF. So part of what we're just doing is we are pumping up the profits of some of these rural phone companies. And you know what? You've got to make some hard decisions sometimes and say, you know, look, it would be great if we could make everything free for everybody, but, you know, that's not the way the world works.
Well, plus, I suspect if you're giving someone digital connectivity, that probably includes phone service as a part of it, which it doesn't mean in the
real everybody universe. Gets a car a Swiss Army knife in the glove compartment.
The economy, so we should, I mean, I do think it's clear that we're not in the near term going to be putting in some new new additional pipe. There just isn't the capital to expend on putting in a new pipe, and that's why we have to look at ways of both innovating and legislating to make sure that the existing pipes that are out there stay open and are more available.
Got it. Vera France from OSI, there's something you wanted to add. OSI is an open society institute.
Exactly. So I want to touch upon another topic. So we talked a lot about ownership. But coming from Europe, I live in London, I'm a lot concerned with privacy. We haven't discussed that at all. And I'm just wondering how that features in this debate. And in particular, for example, some of you might be aware that in France, in particular, there has been a proposal where the French government proposes that ISPs should monitor the internet. And if they discover that any user shares infringing content, as they call it, the user first gets a warning, then might be disconnected from the internet for up to a month, and eventually could be disconnected from the internet for up to a year and be be put on a blacklist in that country. So basically be without internet access in the home for up to a year. So I just, anyhow, want to put this on the table and see what...
It's an enormous issue and growing, and while you weren't in London over the last couple of days, the UK is actually taking the lead with a large initiative to put up billions of dollars to make sure that there's a pool of all internet usage data, everything that's going through BT's pipes and Vodafone, so that in the event of a traffic stop, if someone wants to look up things about you, they can do it quickly. It's a remarkable initiative, and the danger is, of course, from my perspective, that that kind of idea comes here and gets enthusiastically embraced by people who are very worried about the next attack and say, yes, we need to save all data forever and hang on to it. It's a very difficult issue to address because our government treats almost everything as a security issue and is now beginning to treat internet policy as a security issue. There's a very close relationship between the telcos and the Department of Defense and the government in general, and they've been cooperating for 100 years. Why would they stop now? And so one problem with having such concentrated control over internet access by private actors who are very close to our government is that surveillance is extremely easy and carried out all the time. I don't pretend to have an answer to this. I think more public awareness and uproar. We're bad at uproar in the United States. You know, we really are. We don't demonstrate. We don't go in the streets. We write a few letters.
I clicked on a petition a while ago.
Yeah, great. I was in a cab with a
Russian
guy.
Save PBS. I think it was under threat.
Yeah, good for that. And my Russian cab driver, it was pouring rain, and he was screaming at me about how... you know, wussy Americans are, that they never get in the streets, they never complain. We don't complain at all about surveillance.
Yeah, the French do that sometimes.
There's a huge march on October 11th, Freedom Not Fear. Hundreds of thousands of people in Europe will take to the streets to raise a stink about surveillance. That doesn't seem to happen in the United States.
I want to give one example, because it does happen so rarely, and since it has been a topic that's been addressed, of where, once in a blue moon, people actually did protest. There's a guy in the back row there named Ben Scott, who is one of the geniuses behind Free Press. And there was a moment in time where it looked like some horrific legislation was going to be enacted in Congress. And what Free Press did, along with a variety of other partners, is they actually did, it was 1968 Redux, they actually did organize hundreds of thousands of people around the country on the topic of network neutrality. And you know what? They took it to Congress, and they won because of those organizing tactics. So I bring that up simply to affirm Susan's point that when people do actually get wound up about things, when they do leverage new media tools to organize and make their voices heard, Washington does actually respond. And there's actually precedent on these telecommunications issues, as evidenced by what happened in the net neutrality space, is led by Free Press.
Just connecting up the latter discussion with the former, just doing my best to characterize Thomas Paine's question. God, that sounds familiar, Thomas Paine. Is it possible to basically have enforced freedom? Because it sounds like the first part of our conversation was making the best of not an ideal situation and saying we have to legislate certain restrictions on certain parties in order to assure freedom for the rest. And is that just, that's called a subtle point, and that's what it is? Or is there sort of a paradox lurking in there? I'm looking at you, Susan, I don't know.
You're looking at me, but the reason I'm looking back at you with friendly non-comprehension
is it's friendly.
What I'm talking about is actually structural separation. So if you're in one kind of actor, you don't get to reach up. If you're providing transport...
You're not being regulated, you're being dispossessed.
You're being cut off. Yeah, you only have one function, you don't have the others.
Yes.
And that's enforced freedom for everybody else, rather than just giving, as we do now, freedom for shareholders and short-term gains. And so that's the trade-off. That's the trade-off, and it's a tough one for us to make.
Got it. Yes, front row.
Larry Lessig has been a high-profile technology advisor and supporter of Obama. His positions on copyright and encryption are well known. Joe Biden, one of the leading pro-RIA, anti-encryption hawks in the Senate, comes from the other side of the spectrum. When it comes to naming a national CTO or working with the legislator, who will win the battle for Obama's soul?
Just one word. That's all we need.
It's a great question, and I'm not going to answer it.
You can alternatively say who Obama will pick to replace Martin on the FCC.
I'm absolutely not going to answer that because I don't know the answer. But let me point out that one of the things, again, this sort of, I got to back up to talk about Barack for a second. Barack actually likes dissent and disagreement. If everybody's telling him the same thing, he's going to go find the dissent and the disagreement. And so the advisor group
it's
that
kind of
I run, what's that?
It's kind of mavericky of him.
It is. He's the maverick in the race. Yeah. So the advisor group that I run, there are not uniform points of view on anything, on a single solitary thing. And so while my dear friend Larry Lessig and Gigi Sohn advise us on copyright policy, so too do people who have the exact opposite point of view than them. And I can't think of an issue where there isn't some discussion and where there isn't sometimes, you know, loud discussion. So, you know, if it follows the precedent of past policy decisions, I have a feeling that there will be a robust exchange of paper and series of discussions, and at the end of the day, President Obama will make up his own mind.
All right, just a final two words from the peanut gallery. Roxana, is it? Roxy.
Thanks. How's it going, guys? I don't want to make this question just too rosy about the Obama campaign. I have my Barack website and all that, and it's great. But in terms of generating things for the policy window up there, you know, what are the lessons learned from this campaign that can be carried over into the government, regardless of who wins, in terms of organizing and using the internet to organize and then actually govern? And I guess what are also the challenges that you see towards implementing a more networked democracy?
So hold that thought, internet organizing and governing, and let's get this question.
Right. I just have my name's Tyler Moore from the Center for Research on Computation and Society here at Harvard. So one more bullet list on the list of policies is we haven't really talked much about internet safety and security. And people, you said earlier, people fear about the internet not being a safe place. Well, it really isn't a safe place in a lot of ways. There's organized crime is rife on the internet. You have phishing attacks and identity theft going on. And I think there is a policy component that needs to be addressed here, perhaps through better law enforcement and probably a more comprehensive approach taken altogether. So I don't know if we have any really answers for it today, but I definitely think it needs to be on the agenda.
Got it. And the last point before we put it back to our panel, yes, sir.
Chintan Vaishnav from MIT. Are there any regulatory objectives that currently the telecom regulation serves that you think should be extended to internet just as they are?
So lessons from bellheads to netheads. All right. Anybody from the panel want to take on our final questions?
Well, the last one was the easiest, so I'll talk about that one. Two things that could move over from the telephone world to internet carriage are non-discrimination and privacy. Telecom operators actually have real obligations when it comes to consumer information. They're not supposed to use it for their own marketing purposes. They're not supposed to send it around, which means you'd think that they wouldn't be doing deep packet inspection when they come to their internet obligations. So both of those, and they're very important, non-discrimination and privacy, and they've been in place for more than 100 years. So we really should move them over to the internet for carriage.
Got it. Alec?
And then I'll briefly answer two of the different questions. First, on internet safety, Barack actually does have a policy on it, which you can see on at barackobama.com/technology. What he's chosen to do is not mandate that software
or mandate that a certain set of applications be laid onto any device that somebody buys. And I think he doesn't believe that the bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. should be specifying the type of protections that consumers get. I think he views this issue through the eyes of a parent, which is the eyes he views a lot of these issues through. What he said he wants to do is promote the use of tools to help empower parents to keep their children and their families safe online. So it's really sort of a, you know, how do you use the power of the White House as opposed to doing something statutorily on it. To go to the young woman's question about what can you port over from the campaign that's worked into governance, first, I hope we have the opportunity to do that. You know, we aren't, even though we're doing really well in the polls right now, there are, I think, 26, 27 days left, and I think there are a few more cards to be turned over, and I have a feeling that this is going to continue to be a dogfight to the very end. I think that one of the top priorities, one of the things that's worked for us to this point, which we really want to do take with us into governing, is the notion that we have had a citizen-centered campaign. And very early in the campaign, when Barack first got back from, when he got back from his Christmas vacation in Hawaii, and he was back in Chicago in January of 2007, and he decided to run for president, and he was contemplating how to overcome decades of infrastructure that Bill and Hillary Clinton had built, he made a big bet on technology. He said, you know what, I bet there are a lot of people who can't write $2,300 checks who aren't going to go to townhouses on the Upper East Side who will support me, but I've got to we've got to figure out ways to draw them in. And that's not just about throwing up a website. So we invested very, very aggressively in new media tools to really allow people to engage. A big reason why we won the caucuses, a big reason we won states like Idaho, was not just because we had field staff there, but also because we leveraged technology to allow people to self-organize and self-empower and to take things on themselves. And so from a governance, and then lastly, looking at the party platform, I mean, nothing is more of a caricature of sort of the proverbial smoke-filled room than a drafting of a party platform. And what Barack chose to do was to have community meetings all over the country and almost crowdsource the development of the party platform. What we'd like to do is take those principles into governing. Now, that's easier said than done, but I do think that there are ways in which we can open up decision-making to the American people. There are ways in which we can make government proceedings more transparent. There are ways in which we can allow people to comment on and engage on policymaking activities that are taking place that simply aren't now in sort of the most closed and secretive administration we've had in memory. So that's at the top of the list.
Got it. Rich, any final thoughts?
No, I do think the question on security, I do think a little more policing. I mean, there are laws, and there are laws around data protection and privacy and anti-spamming and things like that, and I do think that they should be more heavily enforced. But I think that in combination with what I heard from Barack's policies, which is self-policing, you want to keep things open and give people tools, but they should have those tools at their discretion.
Got it. Well, we started on a bit of a downer with a global financial meltdown. We ended with a bit of a downer on the threat side of things. But in the middle, it was a wild ride of, you know, interesting stuff. And we can dream, right? So please join me in thanking our panel for coming out today and talking. And thank you to the Ford Foundation for sponsoring this. And I hope there's still some cookies left, because I didn't get any. Thanks again.
Are you going after dinner? Are you going after the dinner thing after this? Let me give you a card. Yeah. I want to stay in touch with you. You're really doing great work.